Good evening and welcome to episode 13 of the Borussia Dortmund Fan Club London podcast. And wow, episode 13, time flies when you're having fun. This evening we've got a quite brilliant guest. I'm really quite honoured. And we've only got the one guest this evening, but he's certainly someone to be reckoned with. I will give a brief description, as usual, of our guest, and so you get an idea who we're talking to before actually introducing you to him himself. The gentleman concerned has been a director of Aberdeen Football Club for 18 years, the four-time Scottish champion, and most recently was chief executive of the club for the last 9 years. We've never had a chief executive on the podcast before, so that's really quite a remarkable thing for us to hear about. And he's also a FIFA commissioner and a delegate at the UEFA as well, the European governing bodies. A chartered accountant by training, our guest is a lifelong Aberdeen fan. As he was telling me earlier, it runs in his family, and he's held down many positions within the club, really worked his way up, if you like, which is very admirable. From club secretary to operations director, managing director, and chief executive. Yeah, the Dons, as they're called in Scotland, or well known, are a club that in fact have never been relegated from Scottish football, which is quite a remarkable thing, and indeed have won the Scottish Cup 7 times and the League Cup 6 times. But of course, everyone knows Aberdeen for the 83-84 season when they won the UEFA European Cup Winners' Cup and Super Cup under the great, great Sir Alex Ferguson. So our guest tonight on the show is Mr. Duncan Fraser, formerly chief executive until recently of Aberdeen Football Club. Good evening, Duncan.
Good evening, Bench. How are you?
Very well, sir. It's been a hot day, 36 degrees down here on the coast. I didn't manage to get a swim in today. Which is the lovely thing about being here in Portsmouth. You can go to have a swim in the ocean, but I've been studying all day, so how about yourself?
Indeed. Well, I'll tell you what, you'd be a brave man to swim in the sea here in Aberdeen, even on a day when it's sort of a balmy 22 degrees up here. But we're obviously in a very strange environment here in Aberdeen because we've been subject to a local lockdown, which is the first sort of its kind in Scotland since COVID situation kicked in. But it's interesting and challenging times for everybody.
Absolutely right. We'll be hearing more about life in Aberdeen. I've never been that far north, but I would imagine that the oil situation, North Sea oil, so things have changed a bit and so on. It used to be the Dallas of Great Britain, a very, very wealthy city, and obviously that was reflected in past successes of Aberdeen Football Club. But the club is still going strong, and we'll be hearing more about it tonight.
Absolutely.
Duncan, let me start off by asking you a little bit about your background, really. It's quite remarkable to be able to call yourself chief executive of your favourite football team. I personally have to pinch myself sometimes. Episode 13 of the Borussia Dortmund London Fan Club podcast. It's not chief executive, but I do get to meet a lot of very interesting people on the podcast and talk about Borussia Dortmund, and including a number of former players. So it's really, really interesting. And as someone who writes about football, I really find it interesting to hear life stories. So perhaps we could just start off by asking you, really, how did a fan of Aberdeen come to be chief executive of the club? That's a remarkable story and must be a very fulfilling one as well.
Yeah, I mean, to a great extent, it very much was so. I mean, it was really, looking back, it was a very challenging period for the club. The club had obviously had phenomenal success under Sir Alex Ferguson, and it had had a relatively degree of continuing success thereafter, right the way through until the sort of early 90s. And it then found itself in a difficult time. It had, you know, it didn't lack ambition. It certainly spent enough money trying to be a successful football club again. But it failed really in terms of delivery. The expectations, as you can imagine, remained very high after that period in time. And the club were really having to look at things in a different way, looking at it from a financial perspective and having to cut back. As a chartered accountant and been a lifelong fan, I'd taken a close interest in this. And at the time, really what had happened with two major shareholding groups, one was a local construction company called SMG, and one was a national, in fact, a very international company called Aberdeen Asset Management. And they had sort of asked me to get involved, take a look at things from a financial perspective, realising the sort of challenges that lay ahead. And at first, because I worked in oil and gas, like many people up here, which was, a very, very good living, I had sort of hesitated before I did that. But, you know, once I sort of had agreed, and once you almost get sucked into that type of environment, you just go with it. So it was very much a case of coming in with a fresh pair of eyes and beginning to look at the sort of challenges we had to face and begin, if you like, to try to turn things around. And it's not an easy process. And inevitably, when you want to be successful, you want to keep investing into the product. But the realisation in Scottish football at that time, it was financially very, very difficult. So in reality, what we had to sort of do was to begin to cut back quite a bit. And the first couple of seasons in particular were very hard. But it began to lay the foundation, for a sustainable football club. And whilst it was hard, it was absolutely the correct thing to do. And what we really spent a lot of time doing over the years, Benj, was trying to get the club to a situation where it was an operational break-even. And once we got it to an operational break-even some years later, we were able to address our debt issues, which was around about the sort of £15 million mark. And with after many years of trying to get things sorted, we were able to come to a deal. And that's when Aberdeen Asset Management exited the club. But we were able to address that £15 million and make the club debt-free. And in many ways, that some 5-6 years ago was sort of catalyst to allow the club to look ahead, look forward, and begin to make the type of decisions in terms of investments that you are only able to make when you actually are in a debt-free position. And that's clearly one of the things that German clubs have been incredibly successful at over the years. So, listen, my time at Aberdeen was magnificent. I don't regret being there for the length that I was. Towards the end of last year, so we had an American consortium that started to get involved. They wanted to come in, and I just felt at that time with the chairman, Stuart Milne, who was with SMG for so many years, it was the time for me also to step aside.
Yes. Well, I'm certainly very heartened to hear your enthusiasm for the German football model. Obviously, being the a UK-based supporters organisation for the Borussia Dortmund club, which we've done for almost 8 years now, we've always keen to spread the message of the Bundesliga, the fact that the clubs do manage a very tidy ship and generally make a profit as well. Dortmund made a profit last year of 38 million on a turnover of €500 million. It's an incredible turnover, an incredible success, and a pretty good return as well. So I'm not a finance man by any means, but I can certainly tell that Dortmund are not running the club badly. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, the overriding success of the German model is, for everybody concerned, is the model that all major European leagues need to look at and really grasp and understand the situation. The German FA comes from the German FA all the way down. During my time at Aberdeen, we had one game against a Europa League tie, a last 32 game against Bayern Munich.
Wow.
And I know Bayern Munich to Borussia Dortmund fans is certainly not one of my favourite teams. But I have to say, just the whole experience of preparing for that game with Bayern. We took 7,000 people over there. The treatment of our supporters, our club, because actually we've beaten Bayern Munich to win the European Top Winners Cup in the quarter final.
Right.
In 1983, and the president of Bayern at that time, when we played them again, was Karl-Heinz Rummenigge. And I have met Karl-Heinz Rummenigge on two or three occasions since then during the European Club Association days when he was heavily involved. And he could not have welcomed our club and dealt with our club in any better way. And I think in reality, the point I'm really trying to get across, there's a number of other points we need to discuss. But I think they just know how in Germany to do things properly. And that goes right across every single club and every single organisation. And they treat people the right way. They deal with things the right way. And you know, I still go back to when I first got involved in football. Germany had had a bad World Cup, if you remember right, in 1998, I think it was. And yet right away, rather than just sort of start blaming one another or trying to look for scapegoats, the Germans decided, you know what, we're hosting the World Cup in 8 years' time. We've got to be ready to begin to address some of our challenges. And they went out and did that. And I think that's testimony to just the real philosophy of German football. And I can't speak highly enough of it.
Yeah, I think it was 2000, as you correctly pointed out, it was 8 years later. And ironically, there was a British coach involved who drafted a blueprint. The name escapes me right now, but there was a British influence in that. And it was, I can't remember, but they certainly have become, there's a sort of admiration that the Germans also have for the success of the Premier League and the commercial success and the way it's run. But as you can imagine, the Premier League, in terms of its commercialization, is pretty abhorrent to real football fans. And a lot of us would prefer to go to watch, like myself, go and watch Portsmouth in League One, or you know, something like that, where you get real football, or go over to Germany to watch Borussia Dortmund, obviously. It is a problem when it becomes a commercial business. Has commercialism become an issue for the Aberdeen fans? Was there ever a sense that,
I think it's become an issue for all Scottish fans. Sense that if we look at Scottish football, the greatest part of the income still remains key receipts. Whilst obviously in England the Premier League is dominated by television revenues, I mean, to fail in the Premier League and finish bottom and get £100 million in television receipts just seems to most people, when Celtic are Scottish champions, might get £3 million. Just seems abhorrent, and
amazing.
It just the problem for Scotland is just that England and ourselves border one another. So the challenges around what happens in the English game has a major impact in terms of the Scottish game. I mean, I noticed the other day, I don't know if you came across it, but Neil Warnock was saying that Celtic and Rangers would be in the top six in the English Premier League if they were there. Because Bournemouth, I think, had said that they were a bigger club than Rangers. Now, you know, a lot of people in England just died Bournemouth for saying that, but the principle on which you've seen it is absolutely right, in the sense that Celtic and Rangers have the same television deal. If they were playing in the English Premier League with that type of television money, the supporter base worldwide would probably just come behind Liverpool and Manchester United in that regard. So it is a difficult situation we find ourselves in Scotland with having such a big neighbour as England. And I think what I have most admiration for, I always point to Germany in this regard. I remember when financial fair play came in Europe, the Germans in particular were very, very driven that this had to become part and parcel of football. And many have seen it as an attack on the English Premier League. And indirectly, I suppose, there was a degree of that. But what subsequently happened was the English Premier League then got a television deal that blew everybody else out of the water.
Yeah.
I think what I really like about the German television and the way they operate is this. Next to the Premier League, the Germans have the best television contract. It's not at that level, but it's still a sizable level of a contract. And what the Germans do, it seems to me, from the outside looking at, they say, listen, we've got a great contract. What we need to go alongside that is full stadiums. And we want to make sure that supporters benefit from that great contract.
Spot
and
on.
Every single German stadium is packed. And it just seems to me that the Premiership really, really thought about it a little bit more, that they would find themselves in a position where if some of those benefits could just be passed back to supporters, I think that would go a long way to addressing some of the genuine concerns that people do have around attending football games. Because in reality, Ben, the television contract in the UK, when it comes up again, is going to be under considerable pressure.
Absolutely right.
It's not going to come up with bigger numbers it's got at the moment. So I think there's a real challenge facing English football. And again, the Germans have led the way.
Yeah, good to hear. Well, I mean, as somebody who spent half of their childhood growing up in Germany, I'm always, I love the Bundesliga, and Borussia Dortmund are an extraordinary club. It sounds to me, Duncan, like you should go out and watch a Borussia Dortmund game and meet some of the people over there at the club, some of the management. It sounds like you'd love to meet them.
Well, I've had the pleasure of being at a couple of games in Germany through UEFA. One was involved Germany and Holland, which was in Gelsenkirchen, which is a place that your guys will know very, very well, very close to Dortmund itself.
We do, but they're also our arch enemies. The word beginning with S that we don't say.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the fact that they are. Another local rival that I was in just a few months ago was Borussia Mönchengladbach. And they had a European tie that was out. And again, what struck me was the real passion of the supporters at the grounds. I mean, the stadiums in Germany are just absolutely fantastic to me. But interestingly, you talk about this, Ben, one of my best football experiences. I've seen football all over Europe, whether that was Aberdeen involved or I've been in locations with UEFA, etc. But I had the pleasure of must have been 5-6 years ago. I mean, the second time I went to Craig Bell was a great friend of mine, and Craig had just sort of taken over Aberdeen. And he'd taken the squad to Germany for a pre-season, and they played on the Wednesday night, or was it even Thursday night, they played Werner Brun in one of these
municipal
stadiums that Germany has. 7,000 locals packed in, and Bremen played well. I mean, it was 2-0 there, but it was a real eye-opener. Now, 2 days later, we were due to play in Hamburg against St. Pauli. And so I had sort of turned up there on the Friday, and we went to St. Pauli that Saturday afternoon. The temperature was 30 degrees. It was absolutely, it was so hot pitch side. Turned up to the stadium, and there's 15,000 people in there, and what an atmosphere that was. We played a lot of young players, we ended up drawing 1-1.
Great. Milan Tor, yep.
Fantastic. The supporters were absolutely brilliant. To me, it just again demonstrated that whichever team you support in Germany, local people get so behind them. It's just a pleasure to be there, and it's the sort of depth of that. And of course, as you were saying, you're in Portsmouth. I mean, Portsmouth's a super club as well. Great supporters, great affinity with the local area. And it's what
yes, that's true.
It's what probably attracts a lot of your British members to go over to Germany to just be part of that culture.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And it's interesting to hear that you've been to the Weserstadion Bremen. It's an amazing small ground compared to Dortmund. I mean, 80,000 that Dortmund have is pretty remarkable. Werder is obviously a legendary club that have had a very bad season this year. They almost went down. They had to play the relegation playoffs.
And it surprised me to see, but again, I think it just demonstrates the strength that the Bundesliga have. I mean, to stay in that league, I mean, anybody that picked up on some of the games will probably have a really good understanding of German football, that there is no such thing as a meaningless game, in the sense that depth is there, that you're either going for the title, you're going for Champions League, you're going for Europe, or in some cases what ends up happening, 1 week you could be going for Europe, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, if you get 2 or 3 bad results, you could be in amongst the top five to avoid relegation. I mean, it's the nature of that league. And you just have to look at the second tier in Germany. There's some really big clubs in there.
Yeah, like Hamburg, for example.
Hamburg, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. Continuing in that vein, I think I would love to ask you, really, I've been thinking about, you know, obviously when you get to talk to people like yourself, it brings back, you know, certain, you have certain kind of memories from, you know, the Aberdeen Football Club, for example, the Scottish national team and so on. And I've been researching the Scottish national team I think it would be fair to say that this year there's a good chance for Scotland playing against Israel, I believe, in October to make it to the Euros. But it hasn't been very easy for Scotland, really, has it, the last 20, 25 years? I mean, it's been pretty poor, quite frankly. As somebody so in a position of leadership in Scottish football, Is that really, would you say that it's to do with the finances, or is it just to do with perhaps the interests that young people have, or has not enough been done for grassroots football? I know that you've been involved with the SFA, so it's a difficult question, but how would you, you're an admirer of German football, and German football invest enormous amounts in grassroots football, and that's really the key to the success. Certainly Borussia Dortmund have one of the best academies in Europe, you know, it pays off in spades, basically. Players like Christian Pulisic came in as 14, 15-year-olds and then get sold for 60 million. You know, it's a remarkable achievement that the Borussia Dortmund, Jadon Sancho being another one, although we don't know whether he's actually going to be moving to Manchester United, but he came in as a 17-year-old for 3 million, and Man United are now talking about 100 million. Now, as I said, the emphasis on this show is not talking about the commercial side. It's more about the respect and love for Borussia Dortmund, and also just talking about important issues of European football. And I hope tonight to talk about the SPL season. But I'd also love to hear more about your career as well, and also what you do with the international governing bodies. But allow me, if you will, to ask you just really about the Scottish national team. And, you know, we look back to the 70s and 80s, and, you know, there were some absolutely phenomenal Scottish players in the English First Division. In fact, some of the very best Scottish players, such as, well, I don't even need to name the names, but Steve Archibald, Kenny Dalglish, Alec McLeish, and others. You could go on and on and on and on. Joe Jordan was another one who played at AC Milan, who I remember when I was growing up, although that's a very long time ago. But apart from Oliver Burke, there haven't been that many real outstanding success stories. And Oliver seems to be going slightly off the boil. I mean, What is it? Do you think that's about Scottish football the last 25 years, really, that they can't reproduce the achievements? I mean, qualifications for international tournaments have been few and far between.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back, I mean, for many years, if you look at Scotland England games, for example, I've been a number of those over the years. There's been maybe 100 or so of those, and the record's almost 50-50, but the reality is that Scotland, over the last 20 years, has failed in that regard. The 60s were a great period. Scotland has a phenomenal team in the 1960s. If they qualified for the World Cup in 66, who knows what might have been possible. 74, 78,
at World Cup level for the match to be Holland. They went through a great period after the tragic death of John Cena, and that's an occasion, a game that I'll never forget, being at when Scotland drew the Wales, and that got us towards 86. And Sir Alec was, I believe, manager at the time, took us to the World Cup in Mexico in 86. What then happened is a guy called Andy Roxburgh took over the Scotland manager level.
Is Craig Brown, is it?
Yeah, Craig Brown was meticulous at getting the best out of the squad. But Craig packed down, this is actually a German link, he ended up with Bertie Vokes as manager. And Bertie's treated as Scotland manager. Let's just try to be as diplomatic as we can. Let's just say it wasn't very successful.
Yes.
And what really happened over that period, my take on it, was English football, as the money began to increase, for foreign players as opposed to Scottish players. And on top of that, Scotland began to bring in more and more foreign players also.
Yes.
But not at the level and standard. So it blocked the route for many Scottish players. That had really lost a generation. And what we've tried to do over the last few seasons is we brought in fantastic academies across some of the leading Scottish clubs. And it is beginning to come through. I think we began to see a generation of young Scottish players coming through. And there's a lot more in the pipeline. If you look at down in England, there's a kid that people will be beginning to pick up on called Billy Gilmore, who came out of Rangers Academy. He's a fantastic talent, and he's been making an impact at Chelsea only. And off the top of my head, this is a really great, I just can't remember, but Bayern Munich, the start of the year, signed someone out of the Celtic. Celtic was 17, 18. So we are beginning to see the quality players coming through. Will they qualify for the Euros this time round? I hope so. But there's other green shoots out there. But you know, when you raise the point, it's participation. And that's the challenge throughout Europe. The best way to go forward is to grow the game by participation. And again, go back to Germany. If you go, what the Germans did after 2006, they made a lot of money out of that tournament. And they invested in local facilities, the length and breadth of the country. And what the local teams did is they go in and coach, and then they begin to see the good young players coming through. And if you look at the grassroots in the UK, we still don't have big grassroots facilities in the UK. For all the money that the Premiership makes, point out to me where local facilities are excellent in the UK, most Cameron villages have local facilities, so great facilities. So there is a real challenge. But I do think that we are beginning to see the beginning of progress being made in Scotland. It's not something you can come about very, very quickly. We've gone through numerous reviews. We have attempted to learn from other countries. And let's just hope that we are beginning to see, you know, a turn in Scottish football. Because one thing the Scots, and I think the Irish are very good at this as well, when they're involved in major finals, the supporters alone bring to it a colour of occasion that people like to see.
That's true.
For me, we are going to see the game. But interesting, you brought up the amount of players, English players, that German clubs have signed over the years. And to me, again, that in some ways has shown the feelings of the Premier League in England. Because there's clearly been blockage for some of these English players to get through, yet they're able to go to the Bundesliga and express themselves and develop. And of course, the problem then for English clubs is they all want to buy them back. And of course, the Germans are canny individuals, and this was something we spoke about when I was last in Germany at the tail end of last year. There's a massive premium on English players. What the German clubs have and are being brought back to the Premier League. So, you know, it's pretty clear that Dortmund are in a very small position there. If a lot of ball is going to leave the club and go to the stands.
Absolutely spot on, and that's certainly something which Tony Woodcock, who was only the second English player to play in the Bundesliga after the great Kevin Keegan, who I'm sure you'll remember. Kevin Keegan was a pretty remarkable character and a pretty good manager as well.
Sorry, I'll just point out, Ben, you've forgotten one. There was one player before them, and that was a guy, I think his name was Dave Watson, who was at Hamburg. He came from Manchester City. And I only remember that because he was sent off in a game, and he was given, in those days in Germany, I think he used to get an 8-game ban if you were sent off. And I remember he got sent off. But Tony Woodcock was a terrific player. Terrific player. And a great Cologne team.
Yeah, absolutely. And a pretty good bloke as well. And certainly a team that will have coincided with Aberdeen in their greatest times, because Cologne were a very, very strong team in the early 1980s, as were Borussia Mönchengladbach. Borussia Dortmund didn't have the best of times. They really only came into their own after 1989 and winning the DFB Pokal against the earlier mentioned Werder Bremen. Liam Morrison, I think you're talking about the centre-back at... 16-year-old centre-back at Bayern Munich. Yes. Interesting to hear about that, yeah.
Yeah, that was... that came as a pretty big shock to Celtic. I know the guys had high hopes for him. I think they were taken aback. They'd always sort of looked to the English Premier League as being a concern for, if you like, taking young players down. And that one came out of the blue. And clearly the lad involved had seen what happened with young English players going up there and going, you know what, I'm going to give this a chance. And I think as much as it's a disappointment, I have a huge amount of admiration for players that are prepared to go and, you know, go to Germany and actually give it a go. And, you know, looking back, actually, Dortmund have had a couple of really successful Scottish players out there. It was originally Martin McLeod who came from Celtic, and I think, of course, your older members will remember someone who, to Craig Brown, was a massive player, and that was Paul Lambert. Developed so much as a person, as a player, playing in that Borussia Dortmund team that actually won the Champions League.
Well, I mean, Paul, yeah, I met him in December. He signed the 97.
He's a tremendous, tremendous football player. I remember Craig Brown telling me the story. Was it Herzog that was manager or at the time when Dortmund won the Champions League? And Paul
Hitzfeld, Ottmar Hitzfeld, yeah.
Yes, and he said, Paul, he told Paul, your job is to follow the main midfield general for the other team. And what Paul Lambert had a fantastic ability to do was just intercept the pass. He had an ability to stop the opponent getting the ball. And Paul always used to say, I stop, I get the ball, I lay it off. I don't feel as though I'm contributing enough. But of course, within the system that Dortmund operated, it made him the sort of key player within that team. And Craig Brown always said when he came back to Scotland that exactly the same role. He was just brilliant at it. He could read the game. He could intercept passes. He literally made, if you were a key midfield player playing against Dortmund, you had a real difficult job getting a hold of the ball because Paul Lambert would be at you and snapping away. And he absolutely adored his time at Dortmund. And remember, he went from Addison Mirren at Motherwell. I think it was Motherwell. Why had Dortmund gone? But that was the German scout network at that time. That ability for him, the manager, to go and find me this type of player. And they went and got that type of player. So, you know, it's a quality within the German game that, again, stands out for me. I mean, again, look back and watch Borussia Mönchengladbach play this season. I know they just qualified for the last place for the Champions League, but you know, a lot of really, really good, talented young players as well. You see it in all German clubs. I think the great thing about them is they're willing to give young players a chance and they're willing to let young players express themselves. And it's something that I think we call call it, we triumph in this country, don't we?
Well, I mean, there's certainly that. I mean, you mentioned earlier about the opportunities that young English players have had to go over to Germany. We talked about Oliver Burke, Jadon Sancho, Denzel Boadu. I was just thinking about certainly. I mean, I've had the chance to meet Murdo, who I remember. I was at the 1987 the UEFA Cup match between Celtic and Dortmund, and a great atmosphere, and then a great fan friendship between Celtic fans and Dortmund fans ever since. We had Joe O'Rourke, the General Secretary of Celtic Supporters Association, on the show not long ago, and he was...
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. I mean, a really, really good bloke. And I mean, there's certainly an affinity between Scottish fans and German fans. And it's good to hear. And certainly your observations are very positive. And indeed, I would intend to agree with that. I think to some degree we've seen cross-fertilization happening, certainly in England in the last couple of years. Pascal Gross played for Brighton. Then we had Felix Paslak playing for Norwich. On the coaching side, Daniel Farke, Norwich City's coach. Obviously, David Wagner coaching Huddersfield, getting them promoted from the Championship. And obviously, Kloppo managing Liverpool and so on. A lot of the backroom staff are German as well at Liverpool Football Club. So I think there's been some cross-fertilisation. But what's been particularly successful has been the integration of young English players. Denzel Boadu was one who, a London-born player of Ghanaian background, who went over. He actually signed a couple of days before Jadon Sancho. So I guess you could say that he's one of those pub quiz type questions. Who was the first English player ever to play for Borussia Dortmund? It was actually Denzel Boadu, who ended up at Crawley Town. He's now at Crawley Town. But
it's incredible. In fact, I'm just looking. Smell Dortmund have played Aberdeen in a friendly up here. I think I'll have to get the date before you go, but it just reminded me of what you were saying, that Dortmund were not one of the leading clubs in Germany for many, many years. I mean, they the same with Schalke, because the very first German side I ever saw here in Aberdeen was Borussia Mönchengladbach, and it was that great team that had Fox, and for me, one of the greatest players I had ever had the privilege of watching, which was Günter Netzer. He played in that great Borussia team during the early 70s. And as you were saying about the teams that played, we played Eintracht Frankfurt, we played Bayern a couple of times, and there's always, what I think the point you're making about the young English players going up there, and I think what I admire about the German game, and we see in the coaches, don't we, that come to England, they all insist on a very, very high tempo pressing game. And it means that when your opponents have the ball, they're really on to them very, very quickly. And I think Klopp brought this sort of spell to Liverpool. And it is a joy to watch, because it's got the technical ability along with the physical strength you need to be at the top level now. And I think that there has been that cross-fertilisation. And I think so many of these English players that have been over there are going to benefit from that. And the other aspect is that what the German clubs are very good at is insisting they integrate very quickly. And I think young players in particular find that the language barrier can be got through very, very quickly. And it's remarkable how those that really go about it properly, try to learn the language and integrate, how much more successful they are. Because you remember another Scottish player that's, all your viewers will know, is called Alan McInally.
Yeah, absolutely, a Bayern Munich player. But the less we say about Bayern Munich on this show, the better. I would point out to you...
I appreciate that, but he's picked up, shall we say, Bavarian German very quickly.
Yeah, no, he was a phenomenal striker and certainly made a very big impression, as a number of Scottish players have made an impression. But I was going to point out that Scotty Booth played for Aberdeen and Borussia Dortmund.
Of course, so he did.
Yeah.
My goodness, you've got me there. I forgot about the fact that he left us to go there, and he loved it. Scott's now in charge of Scotland's most successful women's team, Glasgow City, but Scott loved his time in Munich. Sorry, again, in Dortmund.
We'll edit that one out. We'll edit that one out.
You can edit that one out. And of course, one other player that played for Aberdeen, that played in Germany, was Mark McGee. Mark left Aberdeen.
Yes, Hamburg as well.
Hamburg, and I loved it. I mean, everyone comes back and they've all got a decent story to tell. And the story basically goes something like this. They arrive in Germany. They don't know anybody. They don't know an awful lot. The first thing that happens is they're given, the clubs will find them a house. The house is inevitably in a nice part. It's generally in the outskirts, it's in the suburbs. And then they're settling in, and the next thing they'll arrive at the door is a car. Because almost every single German dream, I've had a fantastic deal with one of the German manufacturers. I remember Mark said, next week the car's at the door. And this whole integration process starts from day one. And getting the players into that sort of environment. And Mark in particular, because of that time, you can imagine he joined in 84. And he said, you know, it was a really critical environment that he found himself in. One of the sort of big German clubs at that time, but he just adored it. He just got to take meetings in Germany every single week, and just the professionalism that was shown.
Absolutely spot on. And I think that's really through the board. I mean, one of the special things of visiting Borussia Dortmund is visiting the academy. You pay £3 to go and watch the under-23s play in the fourth division of German football, which has some fantastic teams. I mean, it's regionally divided, but in the West region, you've got teams like Rot-Weiß Essen and, Preußen Münster and other formerly big clubs playing in that league. And Alemannia Aachen is another one that have played UEFA Cup and so on. And, you're paying £3 and you're 5,000-6,000 people in the ground. I mean, that's the fourth division. I mean, it's remarkable. But the main thing I really enjoy is when I'm over there is going down to the academy at the Hornbuschei at Dortmund and just seeing how the young players train, and also watching some of the the under-19s and under-17s and so on, that all play in their own different Bundesligas. So they all have their national leagues and they all play a national final, which, you know, I mean, in England, I don't know. Actually, I don't know about Scotland, but in England, most of the under-23s don't even play in a league. I think it's remarkable. It's arguable whether it really is ideal to have your second string team playing in the fourth division or third division or whatever. But it's from a player's perspective. I think the Bundesliga is a player's league, and it's a youth-based league and a youth-based system. And that's why the German national team have won the World Cup four times.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
One of the last things I was involved with before I sort of put my boots up for Scottish football was to have the conversation around whether or not we should have B teams in Scotland. And there's so much resistance to this, it's incredible. But I actually think it's a very, very good thing. It generates so much interest in the game when they're playing at that level. It gives them a competition against it. You have to play older, experienced players. And for me, I think, again, Germany is successful, and Holland is successful, Spain is successful, Portugal is successful. Let's look at the successes of those four countries in terms of the European record. It's second to none. So I'm absolutely for that. I think it's one of the other things that the Germans do right. And again, it's the national approach to what they have. And of course, Germany will be far more aware of that. It's a very federal system. It's a the federal government have a lot of power and a lot of say, but the reality is within the Bundesliga, there are real commonality across the clubs, and I think that that has brought with it a constant raising of the standards. So for me, it's a no-brainer.
Absolutely spot on. Tell me, I was just looking through the list of former Aberdeen players, and indeed there's some real greats there, like Mark McGee himself, as you mentioned, and also one of my favourite ever Scottish players, which is the goalkeeper, the former goalkeeper, Jim Leighton, a superb, absolutely superb goalkeeper. Tell me, for fans listening to this, What would you say, what's the biggest things that you've learnt being running a football club, really? I mean, being a chief executive, I mean, hiring and firing, the signing of players and so on, many special moments. What are your kind of special moments for you? Which players were you particularly proud of signing? And, you won the Scottish League Cup in 2014. That must have been very, very special for you as chief executive of the club. But tell me a few special moments from your own footballing career before we talk about the current SPL season, and maybe you'll make some predictions about, well, let's not say who's going to win it quite yet, is it? I hope it's not a one-horse race this year.
Yeah, I think in terms of special moments, I think the difficulty you've got in running a football club is that for your listeners, in many ways, it's not a public organisation, it's not a private organisation, it's a combination of both. You have a responsibility, and again, German clubs are different because of the 51% relationship, and I think that that's a really, again, it's a good model if it's sustainable in many places, but it is that the nature of the business is that you realise that first and foremost, everybody thinks they can do the job that you do. And that's a really strange environment to operate in.
I bet.
Something that the chief executive will tell you. I think the highlights, in terms of winning the League Cup, that was an incredible moment because we had, within that stadium, 42,000 fans. Now, no Scottish club will take in 42,000 fans to the final again, I think, just because of the nature of the beast. Finals are played at Hampden now. There's only 52,000 getting to Hampden now, and it's very difficult to imagine a club getting 42,000 tickets for it. You have to be playing a smaller club in Inverness. We took that, and I was sitting just beside Peter Lollywell, who was Celtic's chief executive, and I came out into the stadium with Peter, and the pair of us stood there. We had to sort of reconnect our eyes almost in the night, because Celtic is such a
certainly does. Makes Aberdeen such a special football club? I know that it's something which is you are moving on to Shaw's New, but just for those who don't really know the club, I mean, what is it that makes them special? What makes the Dons special as a football club, and Pittodrie a special stadium, a special atmosphere?
I think everybody thinks that a local club is special. I think the first thing that stands out in Aberdeen is the only one of the cities with only one football team.
Yes.
And I think that makes a huge difference. If you look at, there are clearly issues around, but you've got Celtic Rangers Park, there's always been other Queen's Park that are in Glasgow. Edinburgh's Hearts and Hibs, Dundee's Dundee and Dundee United. It's a one-team city, so that's quite unique. It's, what's unique about the city, I suppose, its football claim to fame is that the stadium where the dugout was invented. The first dugout in football was at the Tawdry. It's very, very historical. It's hosted Scotland games since the 1910s. And the whole area and the whole team around Sir Alex Ferguson and when he came. And those were incredible days. You know, people can talk about what he achieved at Manchester United, which is phenomenal. But what he did with Aberdeen was phenomenal. And, you know, as a person, I mean, I was an Aberdeen fan before that, but what he achieved during that period, just, you can't put it into perspective. What that was like. It turned what was a Scottish provisional team, yeah, one of the big five clubs in Scotland, into, you know, one of the sort of giants of Europe. We won the European Club of the Year. We beat Hamburg in the Super Cup final over two legs. I mean, it was just a remarkable period. So I think a lot of the legacy of Sir Alec is what makes Aberdeen Football Club what it is. You know, the other aspect, of course, is you pointed out right at the very start, the club have never been relegated. It's like Celtic, they've never been relegated. So it sort of makes that a sort of special achievement. And it's always, as a club, it's always had this market of way support. We, as a club, I say we, but on average, sort of 3,500-4,000 people go to away games with Aberdeen. Quite often, like Celtic and Rangers, we outnumber the home support. So, you know, things like that make the club what it is. You know, we are only custodians, and the present people involved in the club are only custodians. You know, we move on, players move on, we move on. And the other thing about Aberdeen is it produced one Dennis Law, who's been regularly voted alongside Kenny Dalglish as the greatest Scottish player.
Absolutely spot on.
Ever. And Dennis's big regret, he's always said this, and he said it in his autobiography, was he never played for Aberdeen. He only played here once in his last season for Manchester City, but he always regrets the fact that Aberdeen didn't try to sign him. Can you imagine that? We'd had Dennis Law. Jeebus. You know, that would have been something else.
Yeah, it's quite...
So, no... But every club, every supporter loves a club. And that's what I love more than anything. Just say to people, stick with your club. Stick with your club and stick behind them and back them. And back them through thick and thin. And if you do that, you know, things are, you know, you won't regret it. Because for every bad moment, you can have a load of bad moments. There'll be those special moments that nobody can take away.
Absolutely spot on. And you're definitely a football man, Duncan. You're definitely a football man. There's no doubt about that. And you come from a family of Aberdeen. You mentioned Celtic, but also Aberdeen supporters on your father's side. And would you be having a season ticket now? Would you keep a season ticket? Do you have more than one, perhaps? Or would you still be going to matches in the future?
Less so now. I mean, I've barely been back since I left. I think you need a period where you come off it, if you know what I mean. When you've run the organisation non-stop for 10 years, you have to come away, and I think that was important. And I will get over when I can. But the stuff that I'm dealing with UEFA now as a UEFA mentor, that's going to take up most of my time. So for me, that's a great thing. I'm still involved in football, and that's, you know, I'll obviously keep, I'll always, whenever I am, be the first to have a look and see how the Dons are doing. And I'm fortunate. I have very, very good contacts in the other Scottish clubs as well. So I'm always welcome to go to another game in the boardroom or whatever of any club. So, you know, I'll still keep my eye on the Scottish game. But, you know, my desire now is to spend more time on the sort of international side of football. And really, the participation side of football.
Let's come to that.
Sport.
Let's cancel that. I'm aware of your time. It's 9 minutes past eight, and I'd request another 10 minutes of your time, if that's okay, just so we can cover the agenda. Talk to me about your new role. I'd like to discuss safe standing and whether that's something which you obviously you admire the German Bundesliga and Borussia Dortmund. Borussia Dortmund has two terraces of standing behind the main the yellow wall. What's it, the Südtribüne's 26,000 standing, which is the main black and yellow wall, which is absolutely stunning. Well, there's not really very much you can say except that I miss it a lot, and I hope to be going again soon. And then on the other end, you've got the Nordtribüne, which is only half safe standing for the away fans, but it's pretty remarkable. Safe standing has been tried at Celtic Park, and I think it's certainly a reasonable success. As somebody who works on the organisational side, if you like, on the management side or the executive side of football, obviously, you know, we're all painfully aware of Hazel and Hillsborough, and you know, this year was the 30th anniversary of that great tragedy. 96 died and so on, and you know, it's also at the same time it's a huge year for Liverpool as a football club, but you can't help thinking that somehow safe standing maybe has had its day in Britain. I don't know whether it's any different in Scotland, but somehow, as much as we might hate that commercialization of football and the fact that, you know, a lot of grounds are seated, it has kind of made football more family friendly, if you like, but it's also kind of lost its heart. And I wonder whether you are more of a safe standing, are you for or against safe standing, and do you think it has a future in Scottish football or British football generally?
I think it does have a future. I think we all know the reasons why seating or seater stadiums came about in the UK. It came about because of tragedy. The nature of those events are still in people's mind, and understandably so. It's affected particularly the city of Liverpool. It clearly has a tie to the city that people still to this day talk about. My own views, you can have both. You can have family areas, but where there are people wish to congregate in safe standing, I think they should be able to do so. I think, as long as you are standing in a designated area, and as long as it is regulated properly, I think it can be done. And again, in Germany, most stadiums, although I noticed Borussia Mönchengladbach took a huge amount of time to, because they don't have the sort of more modern technology ones. In most stadiums, they can be turned into safe standing very quickly for domestic games, and for European ties, they are all-seater. I get it, but European ties, it's the nature and the challenge of having 55 associations across the board. So UEFA have to have that sort of common standard. But I think for domestic games, I'd like to see it being introduced. It doesn't have to be. It just depends on demand. The demand, I think, for major safe standing sections is small. But if it means in a stadium, for example, 40,000 in some parts where you can have 4 or 5 of them, I think it's a good idea.
Let me throw in the 50+1 form of ownership and the fact that the members, most of the German football clubs are 51% owned by the supporters. We had Ian McInnes and Colin Farmery, who are the two directors that took over Portsmouth FC when they were on their knees, and eventually sold the club to Michael Eisner in 2014. A couple of weeks ago on the show, and they told us about the Portsmouth FC story and basically how commercial interests pushed the club very, very close to bankruptcy with £180 million of debt. And it was really only a fan takeover that enabled the club to get back on their feet again. Do you think, is there a future for member-owned football clubs in Britain or in Scotland?
I think there is a future for them. The history of these tell us that quite often they start off with a really positive and a real positive, but quite quickly can run into financial problems as well. So I think it can work for some of the smaller clubs. I'm not so sure at the end of the day that the corporate system that we have in the UK will mean that it becomes the norm or that becomes more than that. I think the strictly regulated German system has demonstrated how it can work. But of course, it's like everything else, as you say, Benj, it's subject to, as in Germany, as in a number of other places. I mean, we talk about Barcelona having fan ownership, but the models do vary across the clubs. But I do think a large degree of fan ownership is ultimately a very good idea.
That's interesting.
I think the most important one is for fans to feel that their voice is either on the board or is being listened to.
Yes. I noticed that Hibs are 34% owned by fans, or at least they were some years
back.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And Hearts have talked about going to that fan ownership in the future. Their fans have raised a lot of money over the years and done a great job in terms of that. So, you know, there are working models towards it, but it's not an easy one. What's the most important aspect, Benj, for any club is that the right people own the football club. That's what supporters cry out for more than anything, to make sure it's the right type of people that own their clubs. And to understand whichever club you're buying into has that unique history and you have to respect that. And I think sometimes there have been bad examples where new owners have come in and they've taken a very liberal view on what's important to supporters, and that's wrong. I think the other thing that many people do in football, and I've heard it all before, is they come in and they promise a lot of things and they say that things can be this, that and the other, and they quite soon realise how really challenging it can be in the environment football is, where week to week results are what matters.
Absolutely spot on. And talking about results, we'll definitely be talking about the SPL season 2021, which has just kicked off, and get some predictions from you, not only for Aberdeen's finish, but also on who might be the clubs to look out for, and predictions of potential finishes for the league. But let's talk about your new role. It's interesting. You've been on the board of the SFA, and now you're with FIFA, and you've got a new role with UEFA. And I'd like to ask you, what is it that attracted you to be to work with an organisation like UEFA or FIFA? Obviously, there's a great deal of prestige. You bring a lot of experience. And I'm certain that that's a great asset to them. But over the years, certainly FIFA have been very challenged in terms of their public image, certainly amongst fans and so on. And it seems to me that at times that they just seem to keep in bringing in new tournaments, like the new conference, which will be the third tier of European football, and then the UEFA Nations League and other tournaments, and then the idea of stocking up the FIFA World Cup and having it, at least for the ladies, every 2 years, and then stocking it up to, I can't remember how many, 60, 70 teams or something. And as an old school football fan, I've been following football since the 80s, giving my age away a bit, but it doesn't really make sense to me, a lot of these innovations, and I just really sometimes wonder whether they put money before football. Even the FIFA Club World Cup, I mean, I used to like the old Intercontinental Trophy, the Toyota Cup, as a one-off match. It really made sense to me. It's a tournament I've never been to. I've been to pretty much all the major tournaments, you know, World Cup, European Championship, Champions League, Europa League, various different leagues around the world. But I've never been to the Club World Cup, and I'm sure that it's probably a great World Cup if you actually go and watch the matches. But it just seems to me, frankly, I'll be frank, overkill. It's too much, and it's really watering down the beautiful game. And so I find myself wanting to watch less and less rather than more and more. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, my time involved in FIFA is very, very limited. It's very much limited to the European end of UEFA in terms of the World Cup qualifying and all that. So my involvement with FIFA is somewhat minimal. It is really my involvement with UEFA that I'm really going to be concentrating on. Like you, I think it's a real challenge with the UEFA because you've got the big clubs that see the need to commercialise, that see that the national leagues aren't particularly good at the present time, that want to, you know, make more and more out of it. And just to let you know, Ben, if you look at it from the UEFA's perspective, even to run a third competition takes an enormous amount of work. It takes an absolute enormous amount of resource for UEFA to do that. I think what my concentration is going to be over the next period of time is working with the 55 national associations. So it's not on the club side, it's very much on the national association side, about developing strategies that are going to make football sustainable over the coming years, because there's no doubt that the recent COVID challenge, all types of challenges that exist, mean that the beautiful game is going to have to adapt. And what my concentration there in is to use my old financial head to make sure that football is sustainable right across. So we know it's sustainable in Germany. We know the German FA are really, really well run. It's a very successful organisation. But as much as we are the German FA, we're smaller FAs, Gibraltar, Faroe Islands, Moldova. It is more challenging. So what I will be doing is working with the associations to help them deliver strategies. And those strategies will be about increasing participation and making the game sustainable and making sure above all that the governance is correct. And I think that's important for fans to know that governance is correct, to trust in that governance. So that's very much what my role will be. So I'll spend a lot of time travelling around, less time on the club side of it. But I get your point. There is always this challenge between some of the stuff that FIFA want to do and what perhaps clubs want to do. I'm not one for expanding. I think the challenge around in FIFA is the fact that UEFA are such a large organisation within the family, if you like, the federations, compared to the other ones. It's where the players are. It's the federation where the great players are playing. And I think that there's always going to be this challenge around trying to compete. I mean, there's a real argument that says, I don't know how you feel, but winning the European Championship, the UEFA European Championship, in many ways is harder than winning the World Cup. Mm. And that goes back to your point about increasing the number of teams involved. So, you know, I share your view that there is a number of challenges here. My own view at times, I think there are too many games. I think that there are too many club footballs. Football, when you've got the European ties, by the time you've got the Bundesliga or in the German Cup, there's not an awful lot of space left for anything else. I think the other thing that's going to happen in times, we'll have to reflect on how many games are played and how many competitions we have, and make sure that the players are fit and able to compete. So for me, like you, I understand that people have had challenges around FIFA, but I think that there has been significant change there. I do believe that the president of FIFA is the right man to bring that organisation forward. He's a very charismatic individual, speaks numerous languages. And I think that he will, and he is working alongside UEFA, and UEFA are working with the European Club Association. And these are challenging times, but I do believe that the long-term future of the game is great.
Yes, and well, I was I was reporting on the World Football Summit last week, or was it the week before, and had the pleasure of spending an hour listening to and also asked a question to Gianni Infantino. And I'm certainly not going to say a great deal about there is a stress between football fans and football associations and also international bodies.
Yeah.
And I grew up very much enjoying the Three Lions, watching the England national team, especially up until Italia 90, just because of the way the pride that people took in playing for the national team. And I'm sure in Scotland it's exactly the same. But it makes me sad to think that fewer and fewer Bundesliga fans are really interested in the national team anymore. And I think it's because it's been watered down so much. I'll be very frank with you, if I can contribute that. Yep. That I think that there are too many games. As I said, the UEFA Nations League, the European Championships, the World Cup qualifiers and so on. And it just seems to be that people are so passionate about their club and their league.
Yep.
That they're really much more interested in watching, their team, Borussia Dortmund or Aberdeen or whatever, than and they find the breaks that the clubs have to have, where they have to let their players go and play international matches and so on. Most people nowadays, I think, really just fans that I speak to, anyway, find those breaks, the international breaks, a real irritation and are not particularly for it, really. Although I think the World Cup itself is a fantastic tournament, and I'd certainly not want to see that disappear. That a fabulous tournament. I mean, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and I think it is. Benjamin, I'm getting the balance right. I mean, my role will be to work with the national associations, and their prime aim is to get the national football teams playing well. And I appreciate the fact that these breaks do cause issues, but then there's a number of club games played as well, and there's got to be a perfect balance in that regard. And the realisation is, when it comes to playing in these big competitions and World Cups and European Championships, everybody gets behind the national team when they're there. The Nations League was brought in, I think, to avoid having international friendlies. I think a lot of these will be looked at, and getting that balance between club and international football is vital. Like you, I hate the thought that international football, which used to be the pinnacle for players, maybe isn't. And maybe, Ben, we'll have to recognise that's a reflection on the money that's been given to players over the years now. That's the bottom line, whereby in the past, playing for your country was always the number one desire, I think, for a lot of players. And for clubs that are paying this type of wage level, they want them to put the club first. We're going to have to find a balance, and that's going to be a major challenge for going forward.
I agree with you. I can see that. Coming into the last part of the show, as I said earlier, let me just ask you, are we likely to see a European Super League or something, where basically the top teams of the main leagues are sucked out into some sort of European Super League that Bayern, I know, has certainly been very keen on, but also Real Madrid and a number of other teams, Juventus and so on. Aki Watzke, our chief executive at Dortmund, has said that Dortmund would be having nothing to do with it. But, you know, when it comes to the big money, then perhaps we'll just change our opinion about it. And at the end of the day, it'll be such a prestigious tournament. But a lot of people in the past have argued that Rangers and Celtic would be better off playing in some sort of international league or something like that. But, I mean, I can't really see it happening. And certainly I think that those kind of ideas are quite out of touch with people's feelings about their national leagues.
Yeah. I think it's very difficult to... If we take Germany to one side, ask yourself a couple of questions here in terms of England. Are English football going to want to go down that route with the Premier League that they've got? The answer is no. And whilst the English are not involved in that conversation, I just don't think it'll happen, would be my take. In terms of the
major clubs in Scotland, the major clubs in Holland, the major clubs in Belgium, Portugal. There's sort of four countries where football is very, very high, highly respected and done. I think the big challenge is for major clubs in those countries, how can they get a slice of the action? How can they possibly compete with the big clubs in other countries unless there's something maybe done differently for them? So I'd never rule out some sort of restructuring within European football. But if anything, I potentially see it happening within smaller countries rather than the big ones. That's just my take on it. The Champions League, the way it's formatted now, it's getting more and more, it's getting easier for the big nations teams to automatically qualify for. So you're getting there regardless of having to do some sort of other route round it. The most important thing, though, for those clubs that are involved in the Champions League is to make sure that money goes down to other clubs. So I find it difficult to see it happening within the major countries like you, because I think the other thing is supporters won't buy it. And I think at the end of the day, if supporters don't buy something, it just won't work.
Let me just ask.
So I don't see it.
Let me just ask, and it's a bit controversial, but before we come to the last part of the show where I'd like to talk about the SPL season ahead, which is pretty exciting in itself, would it be fair to say that the financial fair play has been made a mockery of by Manchester City? I mean, fans in Germany are certainly very displeased with that, because essentially it means that clubs like Chelsea and Man City and so on have a hugely, vastly disproportionate power compared to Bundesliga clubs who are basically, as you say, doing it right, managing things within their means without making big losses. And a club like Manchester United can sit on a, you know, £500 million of debt, essentially, having been bought by some sort of leveraged buyout, which essentially means that the club have been loaded with more and more debt and so on. And you just kind of ask yourself, you know, is this really sustainable in an age where we've seen clubs like, Bury and Wigan Athletic going to the wall and so on, and then the Championship have just brought in a salary cap and so on, and you just kind of ask yourself whether, as you said earlier, whether the English model is really that sustainable. I honestly have to say that the Man City, for me, it really doesn't work as a fan. I mean, even if I were a City fan myself, I wouldn't be very impressed with that, honestly.
I think it's interesting. All I can say is from the outside looking in, and I remember reading the financial fair play rules as they were coming in. I thought they were well composed. I think the rules themselves and the way they're written are good. I can't comment on the City case. I don't know why, based on, and I have a very superficial understanding of the particular case, but it certainly, what was really interesting wasn't just the reaction of clubs in Germany, but actually a number of the English clubs' reaction was pretty severe in terms of that, from clubs like Arsenal, Liverpool, Manchester United. I mean, taking a Manchester United point, it is a difficult situation in terms of Manchester United. The one thing you would say was, United is a club, huge profits every year, so it can't do that, the thing that it has done, but financial fair play is there for a reason, and it's essential that people operate within those parameters, and any club that breaches that, I think it does stick in the gullet of supporters of other clubs, and I get that. So whilst I wouldn't be able to comment specifically on what happened with Manchester City, it was clear from the reaction of many major clubs, including clubs in England, that they were very, very unhappy with the outcome. And we have to be transparent in terms of these financial trades. We really, really do, because at the end of the day, if there's not that, then fans will turn away from the game, and that would be the biggest challenge football will ever face. If fans lose faith in the game, there's no way back from that.
I want to just touch on Rangers as well, because that's certainly seen some financially interesting restructuring and so on going on over the years. But just one quick question. You were talking about environmental, I believe you're talking about environmental sustainability. Is it not a bit out of touch, frankly, that the Euro 2020, which is now 2021, is taking a place all over Europe, and essentially people will be travelling all over Europe to watch games and so on? I mean, the carbon footprint of that tournament is surely going to be colossal, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, what I was mainly heading up was financial sustainability, but I take your general view. I think it's very much a one-off. I think it was done with that in mind. I can understand why they did what they did, but clearly the whole situation is still up in the air as regards to 2021. I know the work that the SFA put together their bid, and they'll be one of the hosts. It's colossal what the UEFA pulled together to make this work. It's absolutely huge, and I'm just so disappointed for all the people that put so much work. So let's hope the tournament takes place and two, it's a success.
Yeah, but then of course we also had the Europa League final in Baku. London teams travelling thousands and thousands of kilometres across Europe to watch the final, and the stadium was half empty. So, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I think, you know, your task sounds amazing. Personally, I've always thought there should be a tournament for the minor countries that never qualify, such as you say, Gibraltar and San Marino and so on, and Luxembourg and so on. But maybe this third tier, the conference, will manage to...
I think the problem is what's killed the conference right away is the term conference in England and in the UK.
Spot on.
It's the fifth tier.
Yeah.
But it sort of came across as that. But I think that will help. And remember, the big competitions help fund that. People think that these competitions are self-funded. They're not. They're funded by the Champions League, effectively. But it's just getting that balance right. I hope it's successful. I noticed that in Scotland in 2021-22, Scotland lost two teams in the Champions League. So that's down to the efforts, that's particularly Celtic and Rangers, but to an extent as well, Aberdeen have had over the last few years.
Let me very briefly, before we come to the very end of our show tonight, and thank you so much. You've been an amazing guest. Absolutely phenomenal. So interesting. And you know, not only a fountain of knowledge about football in general, but also real football enthusiasts. You know, great to hear the stories. And I just want to ask you briefly, because you have this very detailed financial knowledge, being an accountant yourself. Rangers Football Club. It's not a subject we generally talk about a lot on this show, because our friendship is with the Celtic fans. But what has actually gone on at Rangers over the years? What is it you can say, and what is it you can't say about Rangers? Because they've had a few Dortmund players over the years. So Thomas Klos was there, who I've met, the former goalkeeper. And, Jörg Alberts was there and so on, and other German players. What exactly has happened at Rangers? I mean, how should we really understand that? And from a perspective, from looking at it from the Bundesliga, it's kind of a strange situation.
I think, it's gone through the club itself have gone through some pretty dramatic events over the years. I think, you know, I know the chief, the MD there, Stuart Robertson, who's a good guy. I think that it was interesting. I thought against Leverkusen the other night, although Leverkusen were clearly the best team and deserved to win, they had a pretty good run in Europe last season. Rangers, I think it's a challenge. What you've always got to remember there is that both Celtic and Rangers are massive institutions, and Celtic have won 9 in a row, and now they're going for 10, and these type of things will definitely increase the pressure points on the representatives of both clubs. I can't really go into all the ins and outs and other things about what has happened with Rangers, but I think a period of stability at that club is very, very important to the Scottish game, and I'm sure at the end of the day that what we're in for in Scotland is a really interesting season, because this 10 in a row situation is it's just a massive
massive thing for both those clubs, because Celtic have done nine and Rangers have done nine. And I think from a Dortmund perspective, we shouldn't actually forget, I don't know if you're aware of this one, Benj, but when Rangers rebuilt the stadium after the Ibrox disaster in 1971, it was based on Dortmund Stadium for the World Cup in 1974. So, they took that away with them and rebuilt the club then. And, it is important that they continue to operate in the right way. And, but it will be challenging because Celtic have built up a huge amount of momentum and are a hugely well-run club.
Absolutely right, a hugely well-run club.
So I've not really answered your question, but you'll accept the fact that it's a very difficult subject. But, for me, the main thing is that, as I say, that they're going in the right direction. Steven Gerrard brings a lot of interest to the club. I think this season will be a really interesting battle.
No, I mean, there's been some great ties between Rangers and Dortmund over the years, not least in Champions League in 95-96 and also in the Europa League 2000 and in the Cup Winners' Cup back in 66 when Dortmund went on to win it in Glasgow, indeed, by beating the mighty Liverpool 2-1.
Exactly, won it at Camden. And actually, it's interesting to note that the year that Celtic won became the first British club to win the European Cup, and it'll always be the European Cup to me, I've got to say. Rangers, of course, lost. I mean, Celtic won everything domestically that season, but Rangers actually lost the European Cup Winners' Cup final to a team that we should have mentioned come from a different part of Germany.
Wow. We'll move quickly on to the last part of the show, as I mentioned before, which is your season predictions for 2021. Why is this season going to be special in Scotland? What should we be looking out for? And who's going to be going up? Who's going to be coming up? Who's going to be going down? Who's going to make it to Europe? A few quick fire predictions. I'm not going to put you on the spot, but we'll get to that point in the evening.
I think. It's very difficult to look past Celtic and Rangers, both having a very good season in terms of league, going head-to-head. And I think the games between them will go a long way to deciding who indeed will win the title. I think if you're asking me about Aberdeen, I think Aberdeen will, as they always do, compete very well. I think Aberdeen will again qualify for Europe through the league. And I think they've got a chance in domestic cups because I think that the league will be the concentration for Celtic and Rangers. In terms of who's going to go down, listen, there's a number of teams that are about just staying up. And I think in the first division, I can't see past Hearts coming back up to the Premier League again. Scottish football needs its big clubs in there, and Hearts bring a lot to the game. So it's going to be a very, very interesting season in Scotland. It's now on Sky, as people are aware, entirely. I think Sky have invested a lot in terms of production and how it's going to look. And I hope your viewers down south tune into some of these big Scottish games and enjoy it and enjoy the atmosphere in them. But as we said at the very start, let's get them back with crowds in the stadiums.
Absolutely spot on. Just on the last question, are you a fan or not of the piped crowd noise? Fake crowd noise.
I'm not really a fan, but I suspect for younger viewers it's better that they have piped sound in rather than hearing some of the comments that are made during the game. You yourself, of course, will be very much aware as a fluent German speaker what one or two of the things are being said there. I think the issue is that we've all got to realise it comes back to why we love it. It's a passionate game. But whilst I might not be a fan, it's probably just as well sometimes that pipe sound is coming in.
And that was our conversation with Fraser Duncan, the former chief executive of Aberdeen, long-standing chief executive of Aberdeen, 18 years on the management of the club. And what a great show. What a really interesting and insightful show. So many incredible reflections, not only of Scottish football, but also of the wider scene in Germany, and also his great appreciation for Borussia Dortmund. and the way that clubs are run in Germany. I think at times we can all agree that the Premier League is something of a Leviathan, which can be quite intimidating for the rest of Europe. Perhaps you could define it as the NBA or the NFL of world football. It certainly sets incredible precedents in terms of the income that is achieved and the marketing success, but it also very much leaves the fans left behind. And I think that's what attracts so many of us to the Bundesliga and the way that things are done over there and the fact that you can be so much more part of the club. If you want to connect with the Borussia Dortmund fan club, obviously go to Facebook and click on Borussia Dortmund Fan Club London, or send us an email to Borussia Dortmund Fan Club London at gmail.com. And that was episode 13 with Duncan Fraser, the outgoing chief executive of Aberdeen Football Club. And on episode 14, we'll be talking about contrasting English and German football culture with a number of guests, fans. We'll be doing a fan special for the show. So thank you so much for tuning in, and I wish you all the best, and hope you keep enjoying and sharing and liking our podcast. Good night.